And welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining us. As per usual, can you introduce yourself, please?
Okay. My name is Dr. Halima Musa Abdul, a senior lecturer in Department of Nursing Sciences, ABU Zaria, Nigeria. I teach midwifery in the university because our program is a Bachelor of Nursing Science degree. So it runs for five years. So part of it, we have a midwifery curriculum embedded in the whole of the program. So I teach midwifery at 300 levels, at 400 levels, and then they do their midwifery posting for the whole of 500 levels.
Right. Okay. So the levels match the years that they're going through.
Yeah.
So what got you into midwifery?
Like I said, after my first, during my bachelor degrees in the university, actually I started from a basic school of nursing where I did three years. And then after 3 years, I went into the university to do a Bachelor of Nursing degree, which is 4 years for any person that had gone through a school of nursing, a basic school of nursing. Yeah. So I went to direct entry. I started at 200 level. So when I was at 400 level, I was passionate about maternal and child health. That is what we call midwifery. I was passionate about that. And then I was like, okay, looks like I'm going to stick to midwifery. So during a rural posting in the community, I got interested in taking childbirth, supporting midwives in taking childbirth. So I was like, wow, after my bachelor degree, I'm going to go specialize in maternal and child health, that is midwifery. So when I was going for my master's, I went for master's in maternal and child health, that is midwifery. Mm-hmm. So that confirms that I'm going to specialize in midwifery. So I took that route. And then when I went for my PhD, I won an international scholarship from Cardiff University to study PhD midwifery. I was to study the well-being of the Nigerian midwife. So yeah. So with that, I just sealed it that yes, I'm going to go midwifery full. And that was why I'm into midwifery. Yeah.
So whereabouts did you work as a midwife? You said you went rural. So did you do rural community? So what level of healthcare do you have in Nigeria?
Okay, we have three levels of healthcare. We have primary, we have secondary, and we have tertiary. So I work in the primary, which is the hospitals in the rural area. Yeah, I practiced as a midwife for like four years or 5 years, because while I was at the university, even then I was not a midwife, I was a nurse. I got a job before I went to the university in the rural area. So I was still working and kind of going to take some childbirth and support to get some coins at the end of every month while I was still studying. Yeah. So yeah, I practiced there for like 5 years. So at the end of my university degree, I got a job as a lecturer in the same department. So I quitted working in the rural areas and then continue working as a lecturer in this current department for the last 18 years.
What do you enjoy about working as an educator the most?
I like the joy of impacting knowledge on potential midwives. I like the business of producing more midwives, because we have a terrible shortage of midwifery in Nigeria, and then we have a totally unacceptable maternal mortality. So I think I enjoy producing midwives so that we have more midwives in circulation so that they'll be able to support mothers during childbirth. Yeah.
What's some of the bigger changes that you've seen in education, especially in Nigeria, in midwifery education, in the type of students that come to midwifery? Has that changed, or the level of midwifery? What's kind of changed over the last couple of decades?
Okay, we have a problem now. Now, in the basic school of nursing, which is not in the university, we have a decline in the number of midwives, in the number of those persons that are trained as nurses that are trying to become midwives. We have a reduction in the number of that because, and then I'm doing a study to find out, I'm looking at the hesitancy.
Yep.
in the joining in midwifery education among potential nurses in Nigeria, because I realized that people are no more going for midwifery. Yeah, people are not going, those from basic school of nursing, they are not joining, they are not going straight to mid. There's not this strong passion that I want to go for midwifery like it used to be those days, like 10, 15 years ago, there is none. So we have few persons going, and then some people are just only interested in getting the certificate, but the passion is not as strong as it used to be before. So I'm doing a research now, a low-key research, trying to ask students that I know that fit in my inclusion criteria to find out why are they not joining? Why is the hesitancy in joining midwifery? I'm trying to find out now. Yeah. And then we have for midwifery education and tutors, we have few person also joining and trying to specialize in midwifery. Why? Because they are looking at the value. There's no much money in midwifery. People are going to psychiatry because there's this hot rush around mental health nurses in the UK. So people are passionate about going for mental health. So that as soon as they are qualified, they just go to a job search, get a job in the UK and just leave the country. So we have a bigger issue around that, yeah.
Mm. And that doesn't help with retaining staff, keeping qualified staff, but also keeping younger people within country who want to go outside and explore different countries.
Exactly. There's a serious issue of around skilled worker migration. Why? Because people are not, maybe the level of economy in the country, well, that's a very serious issue, and that I found out in my PhD research. And then the pay, the take-home pay is not enough to take them home, like they usually say. So it's a huge issue. So people are traveling for the monetary gains and for greener pastures as well.
And do a lot of people, because I know we're talking to some Filipino nurses that I know and Filipino midwives, that it's almost expected that they will go work overseas and then send money back to support the family. Yeah. So, and I know that I think some of the midwives in Zambia who work overseas were doing the same thing. Is there a similar expectation from the Nigerian midwives who do travel overseas to support family back home?
Yeah, that is the key thing. Everyone is going because of the economic situation. People are going for greener pastures, and then our currency is one of the most miserable currencies in the whole world now. So people are rushing to high-income countries to get more pay so that they'll be able to send it home to their parents and then improve the quality of the lives of their siblings, their parents back home in Nigeria. So that's why everybody, there's a hot rush about getting job in abroad, finish and then go back. In fact, if you go abroad to study, if you plan coming back home, people will be like I finished from the UK, people were super surprised. Halima, how on earth will you come back to Nigeria? Why didn't you decide to stay back? I said, no way, I'm going to come back because I feel my value, and then I'll be able to give more here than staying back. In the UK, they have nothing to lose out because they have tons of qualified people there. They have expertise around, unlike here that we're struggling with the quality of what we're going to be giving people. And then we need to build the capacity of our own staff here. And then we need people to stay so that we'll produce more people to help
And I think the United Nations has brought out a statement and a policy to, it's listed a lot of low resource countries that they recommend not to employ staff from in the higher resource countries, so that not to exacerbate that lacking of staff from within the countries that desperately need it.
Yeah. But I don't think that law is actually working because people are still living.
Yeah.
In the UK, they are still employing people low-key. The laws are laws. Laws are just like a piece of piece of paper. That policy is just like some piece of paper. It's at the point of implementation that matters. It's done. So they may make, is one thing to make policy, is one thing to implement the policy. So they could make policy, people may not be implementing, and then behind the bars, people may be maybe like sneaking and traveling out and then getting jobs. In the NHS, they still take jobs. So those are policies. So one thing with implementation, and there's one thing in making policies.
And that's it. It's very hard to do something that's going to be global, because you want people to go and support their country, and then you want people to also support their families. So how do you stay? And yeah, it's very, very difficult when the reality hits in that a lot of countries don't have to think about, a lot of people don't have to think about. So you went to Cardiff. So with your PhD and going to Cardiff, how did you end up at Cardiff, and did you have a choice of who your supervisors were for the topic that you wanted to look at?
Yeah, thank you very much for that question. I started a PhD in Nigeria here, but I was looking for fulfillment. I wasn't really looking for just getting a certificate in PhD. I was looking for how to be fulfilled. So I kept searching and searching and searching. I got admission at King's College, but King's College's fee is crazy and it's in central London. So I had to look for scholarship because the money was too much. School fees was around £22,000around then. So I was, and it's, living in central London is quite outlandish. Yeah, it's crazy. So I had to have a plan B. So I have a couple of two students that were having a master's in, they were doing their master's in Cardiff University, my student that I taught during the undergraduate period here. So I had a chat with one of them, and they said, Cardiff is a good place to study. It's also a group of Russell, it's a Russell group of university as well, that it would be nice for me to come there. So I was like, okay. And then I started Googling. Okay, before I spoke to them, I was searching for professor of midwifery anywhere in the UK. Yep. And I saw Billy. And then I saw her research. And then I read a current research she did around resilience in 2013. So and then I read that in 2014. So I was like, it was a new concept. I was like, okay. And then during my master's, I was passionate around qualitative research. Mm-hmm. So, but then back here in Nigeria, we have many people into quantitative. Nobody understands the concept of qualitative research.
Right.
We have very few people that understand qualitative research. And then even those persons that are, we feel they are qualified, they are not also encouraging people to do qualitative research because they feel we don't have capacity to do that for now until we have loads of people. So when I saw her research, I was like, wow, since we have an unacceptable level of maternal. Let's see, if we're able to care for the carer, perhaps the carer will be stronger enough to give quality because you cannot give what you don't have. So I said, okay, if you are able to look at the providers of midwifery services, let's look at them. What problems do they, what about them? Let's see what stresses, what problems, what issues they have around. How can we better support them? So none of the midwife voices have been heard.
Yeah.
So I decided to look at, and I read through Billy's work painstakingly, and I saw that she was suggestion for further study. She recommended that such type of study should be replicated in low and middle income countries. So I was like, okay, that's fine. So I sat down one night and now coined a topic, and then I wrote a bit of proposal for her. Yep. And then I used most of her work to support all my assertions. So I sent to her. She was like, wow, Halima, this is a good proposal. So let's see. And then she sent me a link to apply. So I applied for Cardiff University and then I got admission. Then the next thing, she sent me a link. I didn't know her. I just saw her online. And then I started sending her messages. Then she was like, okay, Halima, you know what you're going to do? You're going to apply for this scholarship. I was like, wow, this is an amazing woman from another planet.
Billy Hunter, so I was like, got it, yes.
Honestly. So I just sent in my CV. I fill in my CV. I send my CV to her. She looked at my CV again, painstakingly, and rearranged it for me.
Yep.
I was so amazed. She gave her own comment on my CV. Even I don't even know her. So I went back. I worked on the feedback she gave on my own CV. So when I finished, I now sent in the application. Behold, after 2 weeks, I opened my email. I saw, congratulations. We are delighted to offer you a scholarship. A Cardiff. I was screaming that day. I was saying, oh my God. And then I called. Billy was super excited. Yeah, hello. Billy has never met me. She doesn't even know me.
Yep.
She only knew I was an academician. I was in academics back home in Nigeria, and I'm a midwife trying to study the resilience of Nigerian midwives. So she was ready to support me, and then bam, I just had it. So I went to Cardiff. I knew no one. I only knew my husband. There's my husband's friend my husband is a professor of obstetric and gynecologist as well, yep, back here in Nigeria. So he had a friend. They did medical school here in Nigeria. So, but he traveled abroad to live in the UK. He has been in the UK for the last 25 years, I think so. So he actually came and picked me from the airport, and then he was staying in Bridgend. I was staying with him in Bridgend. Between Bridgend and Cardiff is around 15 minutes, 20 minutes by train. So, yeah, 20 minutes. So I was shuttling Bridgend and Cardiff until I got accommodation. So when I got accommodation, I just moved from his place to my accommodation to my flat, and that was where I remained until the end of my graduation. Yeah, and then I left Cardiff. So yeah, so I just searched. I searched for a professor of midwifery, and then I saw Billy, and then because I had students in Cardiff, I now called them to tell me more about Cardiff University, and then they told me interesting stories that Cardiff is an amazing place to study. And then I read through a lot around Cardiff University that it's not a hustling and bustling city like in England. It's a quiet place to study. And then it's quite peaceful for me. And when I went there, it was really a peaceful place to study as a student. So, yeah.
How did you manage being away from your family? Because you were there for the whole 3 years that you were doing your qualification.
Yeah.
So how did you handle the separation and the loneliness, or did you suffer from loneliness?
Okay, yeah, I had a lot of issues, so many issues during my PhD. It was very turbulent, honestly, it was. But then I had an amazing supervisor, and then I was actually studying resilience, right? So I was looking at adversity, and then I was looking at resilience. So I was going through an adversity, so I was trying to marry my findings and my own life experiences. So the PhD is the most difficult thing anybody can, is the craziest thing anybody can ever do in a lifetime, honestly. And then outside the PhD, I had my family, and then there was a lot of issues in Nigeria. Then there was a lot of kidnapping, there was a lot of killings around then. And then I even developed a panic attack during my PhD. Yeah. Yeah. So I had to see a psychologist, and Billy was the biggest psychologist I could ever had. She kept encouraging me. And then during my PhD, I lost my brother. My brother, who was literally like my son, he was living with me. And then I came home in between to see him, but unfortunately, 2 weeks after I left him, he passed away. Oh. I was devastated completely. It actually affected my PhD because I became lost. Yeah. I felt as if that I have failed, that I didn't even stay back to nurse him till he's dead. So I had that guilt living with me. So I kept speaking to Billy. I was at my wit's end completely. So I was just talking to Billy. She was encouraging me. She said, Halima, you need to you need people to support you. If you need help, you need to talk. So she kept encouraging me. Halima, you can do it. Are you sure you don't want to take some time off? I said, no way, prof. Getting out of this PhD. You know, when you get out of your PhD, if you want to try to get back in, it takes a longer process. Yes. I knew if I get out, it would be difficult for me to come back. So I told prof that it's better I stay right here in Cardiff. I'm just going to find a way to navigate through, because we believe more in spirituality. So I was calling through the powers of God and looking for strength. Mm-hmm. So that was what kept pushing me and pushing me. I didn't know how I was able to do that, but I know Billy was a very massive support for me. And then my family was a stronger support system for me. My my husband was always calling to support me. While I was in the UK, he comes in and goes back, and then he comes with the kids as well. Yeah. So I was just managing and managing and managing and managing. Yeah, and that was all. And then actually my PhD didn't last for 3 years because of the COVID and other stuff. I did it for 5 years.
Right.
Yeah. I was supposed to actually finish it in 2020, but because COVID came around February, March, it came to Cardiff. Yeah. It truncated everything. So I think we added around 6 months to 1 year. So I didn't finish in 2020. I finished in 2021. That was what happened. Yeah. So the biggest support system was my supervisors. I think I had 3 amazing supervisors. And then my family was also a stronger support. And my friends around me in Cardiff too were a stronger support. And even I have a lot of PhD buddies that were always looking out for Halima, because I'm always looking out for them. I worry a lot around people, around my colleagues that are doing their PhD, if they have an issue, because I have a research experience more than many of them before I came to Cardiff. If you're struggling with anything, just call Halima. So so when I was in Vietnam, I was struggling. They were also looking out for me. I had many of the British ladies too that were also my friend. They were also calling to check me, Halima. I think that helped me. My friends, my family, and my biggest support was my supervisor as well. Yeah.
So who were the other 2 supervisors?
Yeah, Lucy. One, Dr. Lucy Warren, and another guy, Dr. Dikaios. He's from Greece. He's also a nice guy. So they were also checking on me and calling me, Halima, are you sure? And then they helped me a lot. I remember when I was developing my theory during COVID, I was blank. I think I wrote almost 20 diagrams. Yep. They were not satisfied. One day I came up with something, and then we sat with one of them. I sent it to her. We sat down together on the screen, and then she drew it for me practically, because she knew I was struggling. I couldn't do anything. So we did it together. Halima, do you think this is okay? These colors, are they okay? I said yes. And then we did it. And then that was all. Then they accepted my theory. And then that was it.
So let's go back to the beginning. So you're looking at resilience in Nigerian midwives. So how did you collect your data, and what did you find?
Yeah. Okay. I collected my data in Nigeria. I was looking at workplace adversity, and then I was looking at resilience. Now, so when I came home, because I was doing a grounded theory, I had to collect data twice. So I collected the first bit of the data. I look at workplace adversity. I try to understand those women. I put on a criteria for those women that identify themselves as their resilient midwives. So I asked them, who will you consider as a resilient midwife? So anybody that gave me an I said, what example of a resilient midwife can you name? So the name, I was writing down their names. I noted those persons that consider themselves as resilient. So in my second data collection, I went to look out for those persons that identify themselves that were considered as resilient. And then I started interviewing them. And then I asked them for them to tell me, are there other midwives they feel could be considered as resilient midwives? So they pointed names. They pointed the names that previous persons have already mentioned in my list. So I went to meet them one after the other.
And what did you find about those resilient?
Yeah, they consider resilience as being tough, which was not resilience. Yeah. Yeah, they consider as being very tough, very hard, as in. And then I asked them, now, what were their resilience strategies that they used? They told me one was spirituality. One was having a sense of purpose. Mm-hmm. One was self-awareness. One was improvising, using improvisation in the presence of no facility. And they talked about they see midwifery as a what do they call it? A calling. They saw because they saw midwifery as a sense of calling. They believe that midwifery is is their calling. So because it's their calling, it made them more passionate and was able to make them cope in the presence of adversity. Yeah. So, and then they talked about the power of collegiality. Supportive collegiality was very strong for them as well, which was mentioned by almost all the participants. They also talked about professional detachment.
Right.
Yes, because attending to a traumatic birth was a source of adversity for many of the midwives. So a way of coping for them was a professional detachment, which is an abnormal coping. Yeah. An abnormal resilience, but they said they need to do that because they have so many births to take care of. If they don't detach from the traumatic birth, it may not help them give the next woman the care she needs. So they did a lot of professional detachment to support them. Yeah, and they talked about the value of family support system in their coping. And then they talked about unwinding, that is switching off after work. That helped them. And then, that was what they said. I think I had around 14 of them. And then they talked about balancing up at work and then mixing up with people that value you also makes the world useful as well. Yeah, and then making them cope with having a sense of coping during adversity. Yeah.
What surprised you the most in what you found when you were doing your PhD from the responses that you were getting?
What surprised me most was that they talked about, what surprised me most was that one of their coping mechanisms was wearing 5 gloves.
Okay.
With midwives wear 5 gloves at a time because they had no time. Yeah. They have no time to change, to attend to the women. So they wear 5 gloves. So once they take one of the childbirth, and then the next woman is in labor, they remove the glove and the next woman, because there's no time to go and change into another gloves. So they wear the 5 of them, so they're ready to keep taking childbirth across the 10 to 15 women in labor, because there could be 2 midwives on the night shift, but there are many women to collect delivery from them. So all they need to do was to put on their 5 gloves so that they'll be able to navigate the 10 to 15 women on labor. So that was totally surprising for me. And then I was surprised how they do that. But that was nothing for the midwife. They said that is one of the resilient strategies to do, to cope in the middle of shortage of resources and shortage of manpower. Yeah.
And it's that innovation, when you think about why they do that, is they're trying to maintain the principles and practices that they know are necessary. But it's also, this is the reality of what we live in, and we have to modify to be able to do what we can do in the best situation that we can.
Exactly. I think the second bit you've just said, they have to do what they need to do to survive it, because there's so much on their plate. There's nothing they can do about it. You know, there's this thing about what Michael, I don't know that you have read about this, what they call the street level bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm.
By Michael Lipsky in the UK. Michael Lipsky, in 1978, he talked about the street-level bureaucrats, that policies like a piece of paper, at the point of implementation, you have to do what you need to do in the face of events. Why? Because that thing they may be doing may not be the right thing.
Yeah.
But they have to do what to do, so that they have to use their discretion to manage the situation at hand. So that is why they may need to put on those gloves. Even though that is not the policy, but then they need street-level bureaucrat at the street where they need to do what they need to do to support women at that time. So that's why they put on those gloves. And then that may explain that. And that was what I used to back up that findings. Yeah.
Because policies and guidelines are written in the ideal world, with ideal situation and ideal resources available, which we know that. And it can be any country, it can be any regional rural area, it can be anything happening. We look at climate change at the moment, we look at weather changes and patterns, we look at fires, we look at floods. Yeah. That changes the situation. It's no longer ideal, and you have to be able to improvise.
Yeah.
So when you look at the kind of the demand that's on Nigerian midwives and working, you look at the money that you're kind of getting paid to do that. You're looking at the stress and the burnout and the moral distress that midwives are kind of going through. What has been done to try and change that, to try and keep midwives healthy and happy within the job?
I'm afraid they've not been anything done seriously.
Right.
So we need to keep talking. Change don't happen overnight. You need to keep talking. You need to also join policymakers. You need to find a way of joining politics, because if you are not in the kitchen at some point, you should find your way to the dining so that you should be able to make policy. You need to be able to contribute to policies to see if the change will happen. I remember that I recommended in my PhD that midwives should rise up to the occasion and take up political position so that they will have a say in their own stake, in their own positions. Or else, if you keep looking at yourself that no, midwife can't say much, you need to rise up to the occasion. You need change. Sometimes you need to go to some strategic point to be able to make the change you want to see happening. So you need to talk. You need to join, like I've said, join political positions and see if you can create that change that you want. Yeah.
What do you see as the future of midwifery in Nigeria?
Yeah, I think midwifery, if we have a lot of people like us that are passionate about midwifery, I think midwifery will change. And then I'm beginning to get linked to somebody in the council that is also doing a PhD in midwifery right now, to see how we can all work together and see how we can change the position of midwifery in Nigeria. Because midwifery is still not valued.
Yeah.
They all keep talking about nursing. But what about midwifery? Midwifery is a beautiful career. It's on its own itself. So why won't we be valued? We are taking we are taking care of two lives, the mother and the baby. So we should be valued. What the heck? We are doing so much because we are trying to support the woman through antenatal. At labor, we are fighting too hard to see the mother is out of distress. Not only the mother, the baby may also be having a fetal distress. So you need to fight hard to save the life of two lives, the mother and the baby. So midwifery should be changed. People should work together and see how their voices can be heard, and then for midwifery to change as well.
I think that was one of the really good things that I experienced at the ICM, and it was really unfortunate that you weren't able to make it this year. That community of conversation and similarities, but also looking at some of the amazing work some of the midwifery advocates have done in Canada to change the system over there, and being able to bring in some of the young leaders who are just amazing for when you think about what they're going to be able to do for the future. But talking about that energy and going, well, they've done this, we can try this, but it's got to be in our context. It's got to be within our culture. It's got to be addressing the way that the country works, but getting midwifery identified as its own unique profession internationally in every country and not a subset of nursing.
Yeah.
What would you like to see change?
Okay. Yeah. So what I will need to see change is I want to see midwifery being valued. I want to see even the pay of the midwives could be improved upon and then I want to see the introduction of midwifery models to see child models, because midwifery is still terribly medicalized here. Maternity care is terribly medicalized here. I'm beginning to see if the model of midwifery-led care should be adopted in many of our tertiary, even our primary. I'm trying to see if we can write. I've just been working on a paper to see if I can develop how the possibility of implementing a midwifery model of care in rural areas.
Yeah.
If the midwife in there could be supported, and then we'll build an amazing midwifery model of care there, so that everybody will go there. Those complicated cases will be moved to tertiary institution, and then I'm telling you, our maternal mortality is going to be what? Bring under control, I'm sure. Yeah.
I've got to ask you, how did you celebrate your PhD when you finished it? Finally, with COVID kind of like lockdowns in running it.
Oh, so after I passed my PhD, I think I did my, in fact, you know what, Liz, it was unbelievable. I thought I was in a dream. So after I was told, Halima, you passed, I still couldn't believe it. I was telling Claire because I went to 13th floor. I think we were coming out of COVID, but I had my defense August 2021. So, but I did it in school. But it was still on Skype, but I went with the secretary because I was afraid I was doing it in my room. So I went to the school to meet our research. I went to our research office. So I sat down there with my laptop. So I did it. It my viva was the most easiest part of my PhD. Because when we started, my readers was like they enjoyed my dissertation. Like they enjoyed reading it. That every word was straight to the point and very clear. There was minimal typo. In fact, they were so happy. The two readers, the two external examiner, the examiners were amazing. One was from, I think she was from Nottingham, University of Nottingham. And then the other one was one of us, one of my lecturers in our school. So he was like, even before my viva, he was already telling one of his students, one of his supervisees, that after that, he has a student that is coming up for decide for her viva, that it would be nice for you to grab her thesis after it's put on is put out there in Awka. That Awka is like our own university repository where they drop thesis when it's completed. So he had already told her. So one evening she called me just 2 days before my viva. She said, Halima, don't worry, don't even worry any bit because you have no problem. So she actually didn't tell me anything. She didn't want to tell me the conversation she had with her supervisor, who is my internal examiner. She just told me that Halima, don't worry, you're just going to be fine. So and then I went to City Center. I bumped into another student of my internal examiner. He now said, oh wow, Halima, your viva is coming on Wednesday. I said, how did you know that? I know I didn't tell anybody. He said, oh no. My supervisor, his the internal examiner, has been telling us so much about how good this is. I was like, that is wow, this one has told me, has leaked the secret out for me. It's like, this one has given me a spoiler already. So I was like, oh, so that means my viva is going to come out. So that reduced my anxiety. So I was like, okay. That's good. So I had two information from his supervisees already because he enjoyed. So on that day, I wasn't tense at all because of the information I had. So I was calm. And then the internet was frustrating us that day. It was Zoom, but everything went wrong that morning.
Oh
We honestly. So at first we wanted to use the desktop of the research office. It wasn't working. We tried everything, it refused to work. And then I just connected to my laptop. And then it started working. So they were amazed with the way I was calm. They didn't know that I had two information from two persons that I'm going to have my viva beautiful. So I was quiet. So when we started, it was okay. I took them through the where they didn't. They were really interested in where that wasn't clear to them. But my thesis was very simple and very clear. So they just asked me to go to where they didn't understand. So I
Yeah.
took them there. So after the viva, they told me to wait for 10 minutes, and when they came back, they told me, Halima, congratulations, you've passed with minor correction. I
Ah,
was like,
lovely.
can you say that again? They said, Halima, you've passed with minor. I was like, oh my God, thank you so much. Billy was so excited. You could see her on the screen as if she was going to jump out of the green screen to come and give me a big hug. She was so happy, super happy. So she was afraid. Because there are areas I didn't talk too much about, but I knew they were going to ask me. But I was ready with the information. But I was thinking because I had to write no more than 80,000 words. But because it's a quality, I had so much. So I had to reduce. So I didn't say some bits so much, but I know them. So on that day, they asked me to speak about that. So because I've read them, they told me that Halima, you know that theory is they asked me to ask socio-ecological model of resilience. So I mentioned a bit about it on one of somewhere in my thesis. So they asked me to expand more. At least I should write up to two paragraphs. So I said, okay. So when they asked me, I talked about it so well. So he was impressed that, oh no, Halima, you know that, then you should add it somewhere in your thesis. And then they told me, I think that was the only correction I had. Nice. And then it was so amazing. So after that day, we celebrated. That day, I still couldn't believe it because my friends were calling. It was a massive celebration in my school because they know me. I come to work, I come to the office around 9 a.m. I don't leave. In fact, they say, Halima, you're literally living in the office. I'll tell them yes. Because when they leave me, they come to meet me in Eastgate House, our office, and then they leave me there. Then they come back the next day. I come early because my flat is not far from the school.
Yep.
They come to meet me in the morning. I'm always in the school around 8:30 or 8. But they come around 9, they'll meet me there working, and then they leave around 5. But I can stay till 8 or 9 in the office. I don't care because my house is just close by.
Yeah.
And then I'm not with my family. So I could spend the whole day there. And yeah, so when it came out, everybody was happy. They know, Halima, you deserve your hard work paid off, so many things. So, and then I had friends that called me to go to one or two joints to have. I think we combed the whole street. We painted the street red the next day. All my friends were calling, Halima, we need to go catch the form. We need to go there. We need to go and eat this. I think I enjoyed myself that first week. Yeah. Now, when I came back home, my family celebrated with me. We had a mini party at home. Yeah, with my loved ones. Yeah.
So do you know any policy changes or clinical changes that have happened as a result of your PhD, or that's still early days to try and that's a long-term problem?
Yeah, it's a long-term problem. I'm still trying to organize some seminars to talk about resilience strategies, how midwives cope around, try to navigate through the hardship they face at their work front. So I'm trying to design a poster to see how, if the midwives can give me some time to talk about resilient strategies, how people can cope. And people are talking about, I want to talk more about supportive collegiality.
Yeah.
I want to talk about putting down orders down. If you find out your colleagues are struggling, you need to support them. So I'm trying to work hard with, in fact, I have an appointment this morning. After your meeting, I want to go and meet the director of nursing in the teaching hospital close to me to tell them that they should give me a day to talk a bit about my PhD findings to them there in the hospital. Yeah.
That would be, I think one of the hardest things is, how do you support your colleagues when you're struggling yourself?
Exactly. Exactly. So I think we talked about compassion in our paper. We talked about the need for hospital to show compassion to midwives because they may not be able to give what they don't have.
Mm.
If they're not being shown compassion, it will be difficult for them to give compassion to the women they care for. Yeah. So, and then if the women using the facilities could see that the women are not the midwife, because they could tell if their midwife are not shown compassion, they may not be able to trust them and they may not use the facility. And that may worsen our unacceptably high maternal mortality. Yeah. So we need to find a way around that because it is not the responsibilities of the midwife to develop resilience on their own self. So if they fail to develop resilience, it is not their fault, because how do you expect them to cope in the face of shortage of resources, a lot of deaths happening, no manpower to support them, even their pay is not good enough to take them. Their take-home pay is not even taking them home.
Yeah.
So it's an issue for them too to survive. Yeah. So it's a lot. There's a lot that need to be done. There's issues that at the meso level, at the macro level, there need to be a lot to do to support this midwife. Yeah. The midwife then said they do a lot. The hospital environment need to do a lot. The wider political environment need to do a lot to support the midwife to be able to give good quality and compassionate care to mothers and their babies.
How much damage or influence did COVID do to the healthcare system in Nigeria? Because we hear about it in a lot of different countries, and that the staff are exhausted, resources were kind of bad, staff died, as well as kind of patients. How did it affect Nigeria? Because we don't hear a lot about how it affected in the various African countries from the outer kind of higher resource countries.
Yeah. I don't know the magic that happens in my Nigeria. I'm not sure we recorded any much death from COVID. Yeah, I don't know what happened in Africa. In my own setting, there was this rumor that they kept inflating rates of people that are dying because we're not seeing death in the hospital. Like it was mentioned in the media that so number of people are dying. But in the real case in the hospital, we end getting cases. We may get people that have the COVID. They may just go through it, had the symptoms, and then they are fine and back to their feet.
Yeah.
But we didn't have people dying consistently from COVID. We may record some few cases, but it's not as bad as people are seeing. Yeah, yeah.
So what's next? You've talked about the resilience education. You've talked about the current study that you're doing. What else have you got planned for the future?
Yeah, I'm thinking of a postdoc, but I want to exhaust, I'm thinking of it for against next year. I want to see in the next 6 months if I'm able to come up with 2 papers for my PhD or 3 papers. I've written one already published in African Journal of Midwifery.
Yeah.
I had a paper. Yeah. And then I've done series of conferences. I've done 7 conference papers. From my PhD.
Fabulous.
So so I want to complete 2 papers before the end of this year. At least I want to have 3 papers before the end of this year, and then by next year I'm working on a proposal to send to either UTC in Australia for my PhD, for my postdoc. I mean,
did you end up presenting at the virtual International Day of the Midwives about your PhD?
Yeah, I've done a lot.
So what year did you do your PhID presentation for VIDM? Because people can go to the YouTube channel and they can actually have a look at all the presentations over the last few years and actually have a look if they want to go a bit more detail on what your presentation was.
Yeah, I think I've had two presentations for my PhD at the Virtual International Day of the Midwife. And then I had Maternity Expo Conference in England, in London. That was in 2019.
So there's enough reading, and then we'll put the publications for your other paper and the compassionate one, the links to your research when this episode goes out as well, as usual.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I think I enjoy speaking about my PhD, and I'm happy you're able to ask me some of the things, and I'm happy to contribute to what you're also doing, as long as it's going to make midwifery go further and then midwifery be valued and recognized as well. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that's kind of hopefully what we all want, is the recognition of not only the role, the specialty of the role, but how the research that we're doing is important for future generations as well.
Exactly, yeah.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.